I heard that when you were born, there was so much oil that you switched to making everything out of it, and that most of these things would be used once and thrown away. A couple of years ago, Mom and Dad got scavenger permits for the dump. Mom said they'd struck it rich. They found a bunch of plastic bags that hadn't decomposed one bit, and inside them were lots of things made of plastic. You guys sure were smart to preserve all that stuff so neatly in those bags. M. Well, thank you, but it was just a lucky accident. You're right that we made everything from oil by turning it into plastic. Furniture upholstery, grocery bags, toys, bottles, clothes, medicines, even baby diapers were made from oil. The list of what was made with oil and byproducts of oil was endless. Aspirin, cameras, golf balls, car batteries, carpet, fertilizers, eyeglasses, shampoo, glue, computers, cosmetics, detergents, telephones, food preservatives, footballs, insecticides, luggage, nail polish, toilet seats, pantyhose, toothpaste, pillows, soft contact lenses, tires, pins, CDs, sneakers, you name it, and it came in some way from oil. Man, we were hooked on the stuff. We would take a drink from a plastic bottle and throw it away. We might burn a gallon of oil to drive to a store for a gallon of milk, which came in a plastic bottle, too. Every Christmas, your grandmother would get presents mostly made of plastic under a plastic Christmas tree, but made to look real. And yes, it's true we even wrapped our garbage in plastic and tossed it out. A. Where did people come up with the idea for burning oil? Why would you burn something you have only a little bit of? Did people burn diamonds back then too? M. No, people didn't burn diamonds. Diamonds were considered precious. Oil was considered precious too, but no one cared. We just turned it into gasoline, lit a spark plug, and burned the damn stuff any chance we could. A. What was it like when you couldn't breathe because of the dirty air caused by burning what you called gasoline? Didn't that make you realize that anything that came from oil wasn't supposed to be burned? Maybe that smell was nature's way of trying to tell you, don't burn me. M. Ooh, that smell. It was nature's way of telling you something's wrong. What were we thinking? What were we singing? A. Huh? M. Never mind. A. But it was poisoning you, and you didn't have breathing stations like we do now, so what did you do? M. People would just have to suck it up and breathe it in. This caused millions of people to suffer and die. No one wanted to say it was air pollution from burning fossil fuels that was making it hard to breathe, so doctors said we had asthma or allergies. While you think of a ride in an automobile as something you do at a museum, in those days most people were commuting 20, 30, even 40 miles to work, and they hated the hours they spent trapped in their cars. It put them in really bad moods. A. So you burned up all the precious oil while hating yourselves? Weird. M. Hey, I didn't say we hated ourselves. We hated the commute, but lots of people thought it was worth it because they didn't want to live in cities that had lots of different people living in them. A. What I don't get is if you were having all this fun, driving around and stuff, using up all our oil, why didn't you plan to switch over to another fuel before you ran out so you could keep having fun? M. The American people were the kind of people who would get stuck on doing things one way and never want to change. A. What's American? M. Let's not get into that. A. My sixth grade teacher told us one of your leaders believed hydrogen fuel cells would replace gasoline cars, but they didn't. That was crazy. Today every kid knows that hydrogen is hard to get. Sure, it's an H2O, but it takes a lot of energy to break off the hydrogen, and a lot of energy was what you didn't have. Duh. M. You're right, Anne. We were all hepped up on so much Prozac and cable television that we always believed what our leaders told us. We even believed them when they said that hydrogen was the second coming, limitless, pollution-free energy that will soon replace oil. We spent so much money on our military to make sure we had access to oil that our schools were falling apart, making everyone grow up dumb and dumber. And therefore, no one realized that hydrogen was not even a fuel at all. It got so bad, most college graduates didn't even know what H2O stood for. Soon things really got bad. We ran low on oil, and there wasn't any hydrogen to run our cars, so people got really mad. But it was too late. That's when the die-off began. A. I know, the food ran out. M. At the time, it seemed like a good idea to use oil to grow food. It does seem funny now that no one seemed to realize that the massive food production needed to keep so many people alive could not be sustained for very long. That was probably our worst mistake of all. The artificial fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides, not to mention all the tractors and agricultural equipment, depended on fossil fuels. When oil production peaked, the price of food went up in lockstep with the price of fossil fuels. The world's poor starved to death first. But as soon as people realized what was happening, stores and warehouses were attacked, and being rich was little guarantee of having enough food to eat. To make matters worse, when the die-off began, people could not afford to get to work, to heat their homes, to buy electricity. There were some experts who predicted world oil production would peak around 2015, and they were laughed at. But they were right. Fuel prices began escalating ever more sharply, but it was too late to plan for a smooth transformation to a different way to obtain energy. The catastrophe was upon us. A. Great-grandpa, why are you pushing a golfer around in a shopping cart? M. Oh, sorry, that's from my other dream. Fred, get the blinkety-blank out of here. A. I have a theory about what happened. I heard that your generation loved the sun and laid out in it all the time, just sleeping. I think that's why you used up all the cheap oil, so you could heat up the earth, get rid of winter, and everyone could get really cool tans and look cool. M. No, actually, we were scared to death of the sun. Most of us worked in buildings with windows sealed tight, with machines to filter and clean our air and water. When we did venture outside, we would slather ourselves in sunblock and put on dark sunglasses and hats to shield our heads. But as much as we hated the sun, we hated the cold even more. Everyone was moving to the hot states where it rarely snowed and then spent their days in air-conditioned homes and offices and rode around in air-conditioned automobiles. Of course, this used even more gasoline, and that made the world even hotter, which made people turn up the air conditioning even more. A. Why did they invent nuclear bombs if they wanted to kill everyone at once when they already had oil-based bombs? When they turned the nuclear bombs into nuclear power plants, didn't they know one might blow up and burn everyone? M. 100 years ago, we were told nuclear fission would produce electricity too cheap to meter. Never happened. The second President Bush, or was it the third President Bush? Well, definitely not the fourth President Bush. One of those damn Bushes stepped up nuclear plant production. But after a disgruntled nuke plant worker filled up his pickup with fertilizer and detergent and smashed it into his place of employment, destroying a small town nearby, the program was quickly dropped. A. Dad says in your day there were over 6 billion people in the world. Sometimes I get scared, but I try not to think about the time when so many people died of starvation and disease all over the world. In school, I heard there are now about 500 million people in the world. It sounds like a lot to me, but I get a little worried sometimes that the die-off might still be going on. What do you think? M. Don't worry. The die-off is over. You are safe now. Just keep digging up all that plastic, and you'll be okay. A. Great-grandpa, how did you survive? M. Your great-grandma and I were traveling overseas when the great die-off began. We were able to survive because, somewhere in the big oil region, we found a cave with lots of food and cell phones and a FedEx box. I never would have believed someone could survive in a cave that long and not be detected, but we did, just like whoever used the cave before us. The only strange thing is, there was a dialysis machine in there. I kept thinking, nah, this couldn't be. A. Dad said he hoped you and great-grandma would move back in with us so we could all stay warmer. Even though I am mad at you for using up all the oil and not even saving a gallon for us, maybe it would be nicer to have family here when we snuggle under the family quilt when the temperature drops below zero and we can't get the neighbors to come over. Once it was so cold, we had to get a couple of animals to sleep with us, and Even though it was warmer, the stink was so bad I couldn't go to sleep. Mom said that you even sometimes heated the outdoors just so you could stand around without a jacket and sip drinks. Can you and great-grandma come stay with us? M. Why, yes, I would love to, but I'm afraid at our age, we stink pretty bad, too. A. Mom said you were once famous for a few minutes for yelling about something during one of the oil wars. Now all we have is this old photo of you with your mouth open and pointing at something. And you're using two fingers. What were you angry about? Was it the oil? M. Well, great-grandma won't let me discuss this as long as she is alive. She got all dressed up that night and everything, and she was so beautiful and... Here, hand over that picture, little girl. I'm starting to hear boos in my head. A. Sure, here it is. Thanks, great-grandpa. Any last words? Your candle is almost gone. M. Yes, you know, as I look back on it now, the 10 years between 2005 and 2015 were the most critical time on this planet for our species. Many of us tried to warn everyone else of the danger of running out of oil, but few listened. There were good people, people who cared about each other, our children, and the planet. We struggled, but not hard enough. The forces of selfish greed fought harder. They seemed bent on extinction, and almost succeeded. I'm sorry. We're sorry. Perhaps you can do better. It was right around then, when I was getting all preachy and schmaltzy, that I woke out of my dream in a cold sweat, mumbling something about an overdue dry cleaning bill in Toledo. I sat straight up in bed and then realized it was only a dream, that nothing as ridiculous as all that could ever happen. And so I laid back down and got all nice and cozy underneath the electric blanket and fell back asleep with sweet dreams of Tofutti dancing in my head. Chapter 4. The United States of Boo. There is no terrorist threat. You need to calm down, relax, listen very carefully, and repeat after me. There is no terrorist threat. There is no terrorist threat. There is no terrorist threat. Feel better? Not really, huh? I know, it's hard. Amazing how it didn't take long to pound that belief so deep into our psyche that the country, the world, is teeming with terrorists. Madmen are running amok on their evil mission to destroy every living American infidel. Of course, it didn't help for us to watch the mass murder of 3,000 people obliterated before our very eyes. That would tend to convince even the most cynical among us that there are people out there who don't like us and would like to see fewer of us in the world. Why do they hate us? Our leader knew why, just days after September 11 when he addressed the nation. They want us to stop flying, and they want us to stop buying. But this great nation will not be intimidated by the evildoers. Now, when I say that there is no terrorist threat, I am not saying that there are no terrorists, or that there are no terrorist incidents, or that there won't be other terrorist incidents in the future. There are terrorists, they have committed evil acts, and tragically, they will commit acts of terror in the not-too-distant future. Of that, I am sure. But just because there are a few terrorists does not mean we are all in some exaggerated state of danger. Yet when they speak of terrorists, they speak of them as if they are in the millions and that they're everywhere and that they're never going away. Cheney has called this a new normalcy, a condition that will become permanent in American life. They only hope. They call it a war on terror. How exactly do you conduct a war on a noun? Wars are fought against countries, religions, and peoples. They are not fought against nouns or problems. And any time it has been attempted, the war on drugs, the war on poverty, it fails. Our leaders would have us believe this is a guerrilla war, fought by thousands of foreign terrorist soldiers hidden on our soil. But that is not what is taking place, and it is time to do a reality check. Americans are rarely targets of international terrorism, and almost never on U.S. soil. In the year 2000, your chance as an American of being killed in a terrorist attack in the United States was exactly zero. In 2002, your chance of dying in a terrorist incident was, again, zero. And in 2003, as of this writing, the total number of people to die in the United States from acts of terror? Zero. Even in the tragic year of 2001, your chance as an American of dying in an act of terrorism in this country was 1 in 100,000. In 2001, you had a greater chance of dying from the flu or pneumonia, 1 in 4,500, from taking your own life, 1 in 9,200, being a homicide victim, 1 in 14,000, or riding in a car, 1 in 6,500. But no one freaked out over the possibility of being killed every time you drove in your dangerous car to buy a heart disease-inducing donut from a coughing teenager. The suicide rate alone means that you were a greater danger to yourself than any terrorist. All these causes of death were far greater than the terrorism, but there were no laws passed, no countries bombed, no emergency expenditures of billions of dollars per month, no National Guard units dispatched, no orange alerts, and no nonstop tickers scrolling details across the bottom of CNN to send us in a panic over them. There was no response from the public but indifference and denial, or at best, an acceptance that these tragedies were just part of life. But when multiple deaths happen at the same time, with such viciousness and on live TV, no rationalization with statistics like those can undo the visceral response of witnessing actual horror as we did on September 11. We have come to believe that we are in harm's way, that any of us anywhere in this vast country could die at any time. Never mind that the chances of that happening are virtually nil. A mass psychosis has gripped the country. I'm part of it. You're part of it. Even high-ranking generals who now weep openly are part of it. That's right. I'm caught up in it, too. I live part of the year in New York City, and every day I'm there, I wonder if today is the day when the other shoe will drop. I hear loud bangs outside my window, and I flinch. I see planes flying too low, and I watch them with a suspicious eye. I check out everyone sitting near me when I fly, and I always carry a weapon with me on the plane. That's right, I carry a weapon, a legal weapon. I have a baseball in my carry-on bag. It was a gift from Rudy Giuliani when we filmed TV Nation in New York. It's signed by all the 1994 New York Yankees. I figure I could get off a pretty good 50-mile-an-hour fastball if some motherfucker was trying to break down the cockpit door. The baseball, when stuffed inside a long sock, works well too. You give it a good swing, and wham, a knockout wallop to the head. Also, shoelaces, when wrapped between my hands, would make a nice strangling device once I get them around the bastard's neck. Whatever it takes, by any means necessary, I ain't going down without a fight. See, I'm messed up too. I guess knowing and having worked with someone who died on one of those planes will do that to you. How did I get to this place? Little old pacifist me. Hell, I'm scared, just like everyone else. Fear, the rational kind, is a critical part of our ability to survive. Sensing real danger and acting appropriately is an instinct that has served our species well throughout the millennia. But irrational fear is a killer. It throws off our survival compass. It makes us reach for a gun when we hear a noise in the middle of the night, and you end up shooting your wife who was just on her way to the bathroom. It makes us not want to live near someone of another race, and it allows us to willingly give up the civil liberties we have enjoyed for more than 200 years, simply because our leader tells us there is a terrorist threat. Fear is so basic and yet so easy to manipulate that it has become both our best friend and our worst enemy. When it is used as a weapon against us, it has the ability to destroy much of what we have come to love about life in the United States of America. According to the Bush administration and the stories they have planted in the media, the terrorists are everywhere. Each day seems to bring a new warning, a new alert, a new threat. Watch out for model airplanes packed with explosives. The FBI law enforcement bulletin reported that they faced off a terrorist threat from an unconventional weapon in the form of satin gas. After the tiny canister was seized from a model airplane builder and flown to a special army base by hazardous materials support personnel in a special military aircraft, the modeling enthusiast admitted he labeled an empty canister satin gas as a joke. Nonetheless, the government issued an alert to be on the lookout for model airplanes that could fly explosives into a building, and cable news channels presented experts in mid-July 2003 to warn us of the grave danger. People might be lurking near train tracks, preparing to derail trains. The FBI issued a warning to law enforcement agencies throughout the U.S. about a possible attack against transportation systems, particularly railways, in October 2002. Intelligence officials said they had seen captured Al-Qaeda photos of train engines and railroad crossings. Geez, I hope they haven't seen my Lionel setup in the basement. Beware of shoe bombs. The FBI says the explosive the shoe bomber used, TATP, is presently undetectable in regular airport scanners. And explosives experts say it can be made in a basic lab by anyone with a college degree in chemistry. The last time I saw someone light their shoes on fire was at an ELO concert in 1978 at the IMA Auditorium in Flint. Some guy who had been drinking too much puked on his shoes, and then someone next to him lit a match and dropped it, and the guy's alcohol-laced puke ignited his Converse into a really cool blaze. Look for suspicious people lingering near gas stations. Now there's something we never see, but an alert Oklahoma pump attendant called authorities when a group pulled in with two vans and an equipment truck. Within minutes, police and FBI had surrounded, with guns drawn, the rock band Godspeed You, Black Emperor. Released after hours of questioning, singer Ephraim Menick told Seattle Weekly, "We're just lucky we're nice white kids from Canada." Al-Qaeda may be setting wildfires in the western U.S. The Arizona Republic reported that an FBI memo to law enforcement agencies alerted them that Al-Qaeda had developed a plan to set midsummer forest fires in Colorado, Montana, Utah, and Wyoming, so that once it was realized that the fires were terrorist acts, U.S. citizens would put pressure on the U.S. government to change its policies. Terrorists are trading in sham consumer goods, like fake Sony stereo equipment, fake Nikes, and Calvin Klein jeans. Not long ago, an Al-Qaeda supporter sent a shipment of counterfeit perfume, shampoo, and cologne from Dubai to Dublin. It's scary to think of all the damage that counterfeit perfume can do. Congress has extended this argument of counterfeit goods to counterfeit drugs. How convenient to prevent access to cheap Canadian drugs by saying there's the possibility that terrorists will ship tainted drugs to us. Especially keep an eye out for undercover Al-Qaeda agents with portable blowtorches attempting to cut through the 21,736 wires holding up the Brooklyn Bridge. The FBI nabbed a truck driver who had been casing the bridge and counting the wires. Best estimate is that you could cut through the wires in about a week, so be on alert. Report any powdery substance you come across. After receiving a suspicious powdery substance in the mail, a New Orleans woman called the authorities, and firefighters, postal officials, police officers, and FBI agents quickly arrived to investigate. It turned out to be a free sample of laundry detergent. But that doesn't mean there aren't terrorists out there, even if the authorities suspect that the anthrax scare of 2001 was an inside job by someone who had access to the substance in the U.S. government or government-approved programs. Boy, those terrorists sure are busy. Explosive model airplanes, satin gas, forest fires, lions, tigers, bears, the boogeyman is coming to get me, run for your lives. The only thing more amazing than this phony game of boo is our ability to fall for it. What happened to our basic common sense? You know, that reflex in your brain that used to make you scream bullshit when confronted with such obvious nonsense? This is what happens when your fear radar is out of whack. You're so discombobulated you can't distinguish any longer between the real and unreal. Why has our government gone to such absurd lengths to convince us our lives are in danger? The answer is nothing short of their feverish desire to rule the world, first by controlling us, and then, in turn, getting us to support their efforts to dominate the rest of the planet. Sounds crazy, huh? It reads more like a movie script, doesn't it? But Bush, Cheney, Ashcroft, Wall Street, Fortune 500 see this post-September 11 America in fear as their moment, a moment handed to them by fate via the terrorists to seize the reins and ram the USA down the throats of any people in the world who dare question who is number one. Who is number one? I said, who is number one? That's right, say it loud. Say it for George and Dick and Johnny and Condi. We are number one. USA! 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 They know that real Americans are not into dominating anyone, so they have to sell it to us in fancy packaging. And that package is fear. In order to properly scare us, they need a big bad enemy. Once the Soviet Union disappeared, Bush Sr. couldn't figure it out. Before he knew it, Clinton had given him the boot. The right wing was out in the cold, but they had 8 long years to plot their return. To their rescue came a high-powered political think tank, the Project for a New American Century, PNAC, which argued that America should have but one goal, an unchallengeable, military-imposed, U.S.-run world. They took their first step on January 26, 1998, in an open letter to President Clinton. PNAC neoconservatives Paul Wolfowitz and William Kristol, along with Donald Rumsfeld and Richard Perle, warned that the policy of containing Iraq was dangerously inadequate, and that the aim of U.S. foreign policy must be removing Saddam Hussein and his regime from power. When Bush Jr. seized power in 2000, he turned the Pentagon over to this radical right-wing nut group. After September 11, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, now Rumsfeld's Deputy Secretary of Defense, and the war crowd immediately pushed an attack on Iraq as one of the first actions in the new permanent war against terror. Their next act rushed through a $400 billion defense budget, including $70 billion for new weapons. Because of September 11, Wolfowitz and his right-wing hawk buddies had found the enemy they could sell to the public. Former Clinton CIA director James Woolsey joined in, declaring that World War IV had begun, the Cold War being World War III. By this thinking, the war on terror would be unilateral and without limits. It could last as long as the Cold War, 50 years, or longer, maybe forever. And if you don't believe me, maybe Donald Rumsfeld can convince you. It undoubtedly will prove to be a lot more like a Cold War than a hot war, Rummy said. If you think about it, in the Cold War it took 50 years, plus or minus. It did not involve major battles. It involved continuous pressure. It strikes me that that might be a more appropriate way to think about what we are up against here. Wow, a war without end? If you get the people to believe this, they'll let you do anything, just as long as it's in the name of protecting them. This is Bush's version of the old mafia protection racket. There's somebody out there who's gonna mess you up. Osama, he did it. Saddam, he did it. Those crazy Ayatollahs, they might do it. North Korea, they could do it. Hello, PLO. We'll protect you. Just give us all your money and all your rights. And keep your trap shut. For the next year, leading up to the 2004 election, all you are going to hear from Bush is how there is a war going on, a war on terror, a war to liberate and rebuild Iraq, a war against Iranian clerics, a war against North Korean nuclear madmen, a war against Colombian drug lords, a war against extremism, a war against communism in Cuba, a war against Hamas, a war against... And to maintain the endless war, they need endless fear. A fear that can only be extended indefinitely by taking away our basic civil rights. The right wing needs to keep this war, that war, going for as long as possible because it keeps people distracted. Everyone, except those who die in it, loves a good war, especially one you can win quickly. We good, them bad, them dead, we win. Cue the cameras. The victorious POTUS is landing on the air carrier. This is how Bush intends to run his entire re-election campaign. I won you a war. Then I won you another war. But there are more wars, and you need me to win them too. It'll be that old slogan, you shouldn't change horses in the middle of the stream. But this is no stream, folks. This will be a tidal wave that can swamp our democracy. Give these guys 4 more years, and do you think they will give up their megalomaniacal schemes peacefully to a duly elected Democrat or Green? How many of our freedoms and our children are we willing to sacrifice just so they can line their pockets with all the money that can be made from a terrified nation and a permanent war? You are not going to be killed by a terrorist. We have seriously lost our sense of perspective, and it is being used against us, not by the terrorists, but by leaders seeking to terrorize us. A great president once said that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. He encouraged and inspired a nation. Now we have nothing to fear but George W. Bush. It is my firm belief that Bush and his cronies, especially Attorney General John Ashcroft, have only one goal in mind: to scare the bejesus out of us so that whatever bill they want passed, whatever powers they want Congress to give them, we will happily hand it over. Immediately after September 11, Bush was able to enact into law his USA Patriot Act, an actual acronym that stands for Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act of 2001. The act gives the government unprecedented freedom to collect information with little regard to civil rights or privacy concerns. The Senate voted 98-1 in favor of the act. Wisconsin Democrat Russ Feingold was the only true patriot in the Senate that day, casting the sole dissenting vote as he stood and spoke these eloquent words. There have been periods in our nation's history when civil liberties have taken a back seat to what appeared at the same time to be the legitimate exigencies of war. Our national consciousness still bears the stain and the scars of those events, the Alien and Sedition Acts, the suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War, the internment of Japanese Americans, German Americans, and Italian Americans during World War II, the blacklisting of supposed communist sympathizers during the McCarthy era, and the surveillance and harassment of anti-war protesters, including Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., during the Vietnam War. We must not allow these pieces of our past to become prologue. The leaders of the Democratic Party, seeking to help the Republicans achieve a unanimous vote, did everything they could to keep Feingold in line, but he resisted voting for the legislation and suffered the wrath of Democratic Party leader Tom Daschle on the Senate floor. Feingold told Congressional Quarterly, "I don't know if dissenting is dangerous or not, and frankly, I don't care. If the worst thing that ever happened to me was that I got thrown out of office for this, I'd be a pretty lucky guy, considering what we're up against here." USA Patriot Act is really a gross misnomer. This law is anything but patriotic. The Patriot Act is as un-American as Mein Kampf. The name is part of a masterful plan meant to camouflage a stench thicker than Florida swamp water. You can always read the law yourself, if you have several days and a gaggle of lawyers at your disposal. You see, this law is not like other laws that read, in clear language, you can do this or you can't do that. The Patriot Act is mostly about amending existing laws. There are 342 pages where it never really says what it is doing, but rather refers you to hundreds of other passages and other laws written over the past 100 years. So, in order to read the Patriot Act, you need to have all the other laws written in the past century in order to see what sentence or phrase the Patriot Act is changing. For instance, here is how Section 220 of the USA Patriot Act reads. Section 220, Nationwide Service of Search Warrants for Electronic Evidence. Lowercase a, in general, Chapter 121 of Title 18, United States Code, is amended. 1. In Section 2703, by striking under the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure every place it appears and inserting using the procedures described in the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure by a court with jurisdiction over the offense under investigation, and 2. In Section 2711, uppercase A, in paragraph 1, by striking and B, in paragraph 2, by striking the period and inserting semicolon, and C, by inserting at the end the following. 3. The term court of competent jurisdiction has the meaning assigned by Section 3127 and includes any federal court within that definition without geographic limitation. Lowercase b, conforming amendment. Section 2703D of Title 18, United States Code, is amended by striking described in Section 3127(2), uppercase A. Did you get all that? That's why when anyone has challenged them, the Justice Department folks throw up their hands and urge the public to read the actual language of the act for clarification. There is no way to humanly do this. On October 11, just a month after September 11, the Senate passed a version of the bill that was less tolerable to civil rights advocates than the House version, to be voted on the next day. The Bush administration did not like the protections contained in the House bill, and with the Speaker of the House, worked through the night to strip it of all the civil rights protections the House committees had voted for. It was finally submitted at 3:45 a.m. When Congress showed up a few hours later to vote on it, they thought they were voting on the language agreed to the previous day. Instead, they voted on the bill whose few protections were gutted by Attorney General John Ashcroft the night before. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, few members of Congress actually read the final version of the act. It was perhaps the most reckless and irresponsible action our Congress has ever taken. Here's what this law does. Your government may now trap and trace all those countless emails you thought were private. If this continues, you might as well delete the word confidential from your spell checker. Also up for inspection, banking records, school records, the list of library books you or your 9-year-old checked out this year, or even how often you logged onto the internet at the library, and your consumer purchases. Think I'm exaggerating? Next time you are sitting in your doctor's waiting room or waiting in line at the bank, read their new privacy statements. Buried in the legalese, you will find new warnings that your privacy protections do not cover the Big Brother provisions of our new Patriot Act. There's more. Under the special sneak and peek provision, agents may now come into your home and search through your stuff and, get this, never tell you they have been there. One of the most important sections of our Bill of Rights is the Fourth Amendment. We all cherish our individual privacy and like living in a place that encourages the free flow of ideas. At the core of all this is privacy. That's why under the United States Constitution, searching your home requires a warrant that is backed up with some proof there's a damn good reason to be doing so. But along comes the new order under Ashcroft that violates our dearly held notion of home and hearth. Ashcroft's law is no act of patriotism. Both my 7th grade history teacher, Sister Mary Raymond, and our founding fellows, especially Jefferson, would not forgive me if I didn't point out that once you allow your rulers to snoop into your life and violate your space, the notion of living in a free society is out the window. Instead of showing probable cause in a regular court, Ashcroft's agents get their secret warrants from a secret court, the government's own Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, FISA, created in 1978, and the feds can just show up, say the magical words, "This is for intelligence purposes," and the secret court judges rubber stamp each and every request. In addition, newspapers reported in 2002 more than 170 emergency warrants were issued, compared to 47 in the previous 23 years. Those so-called emergency warrants amount to no more than pieces of paper signed by Ashcroft, which allow FBI agents to conduct wiretaps and searches for 72 hours without any FISA, court review. Built into the secrecy of the USA Patriot Act is a gag order so that once the FBI collects your library records, no one may utter a word about the search under pain of prosecution. Perhaps libraries could safely post regular weekly updates that read, "No FBI agents have spied here this week," and when the sign is missing, then you can assume the worst. With no real threat of anyone monitoring their behavior, Bush, Cheney, Ashcroft et al. Are allowed to freely graze on the landscape of our way of life. The Patriot Act also allows the Attorney General's office to demand and receive whatever information it wants from anyone just by issuing what is called a National Security Letter. These have been flying out of Ashcroft's office so fast that no one, not even the House Judiciary Committee, knows how many have been sent. The Judiciary Committee demanded to know, but Ashcroft, citing his new powers, stonewalled them. With these national security letters, all the cops have to do is present one, and presto, business, educational, internet, consumer, and other personal data are instantly turned over with no showing of probable cause, or even a foreign intelligence need. The FBI can go after anyone, and Ashcroft refuses to reveal who they are going after, without even congressional scrutiny. That's not all. We now have the precedent of secret detention that might make banana republics envious. Some 5,000 young men, mostly students, have been interviewed by the FBI for no other reason than they may not be citizens or they are of Middle Eastern origin. Another 1,200 people were detained and held indefinitely and secretly, most for no reason other than minor immigration violations that would have been ignored in the past. Of the Immigration and Naturalization Service detainees, 11% were imprisoned more than 6 months before being released or deported. About half were imprisoned for more than 3 months. In a highly critical report, the Justice Department's own Inspector General found that while imprisoned at the Federal Detention Center in Brooklyn, detainees faced a pattern of physical and verbal abuse, as well as unduly harsh detention policies, including 23 hours per day lockdown, 24 hours per day cell lighting, a communications blackout, and excessive handcuffing, leg irons, and heavy chains. The report also criticized the FBI for making little attempt to distinguish between immigrants who had possible ties to terrorism and the vast majority who did not, including many swept up by chance. It is un-American to incarcerate a large group of people when there is no credible reason to think that they are dangerous. Even worse, some detainees have been subjected to secret deportation proceedings. Soon after the September 11 attacks, immigration courts from coast to coast began conducting scores of hearings in secret, with court officials forbidden even to confirm that the cases existed. Now, perhaps some of you are saying to yourselves, as card-carrying Americans, that you are safe from Bush's terror. Don't count on it. The Bush administration has never let the law limit its bigger goals. Bush maintains that he has the inherent power as commander-in-chief, i.e., without any basis in the laws of our country, to label anyone an enemy combatant, then lock them up and throw away the key. According to this novel approach, a wholesale violation of international law and everything this country stands for, an enemy combatant is a person with no legal rights whatsoever. The USA Patriot Act and the enemy combatant designation are just a hint of what Bush has in store for us. Consider something called total information awareness developed by the Pentagon. When some objected to the scary term total, this got toned down to Terrorist Information Awareness, TIA. This program, first headed by Iran-Contra perp Admiral John Poindexter and run under the auspices of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, will have the capacity to search the records of every kind of transaction made by hundreds of millions of Americans. Every query run by the good admiral, for example, give me the names of people who bought an optical mouse at CompUSA this week, amounts to the government asking every person in the United States an intrusive and inappropriate question about his or her life, But these questions are not asked to your face. They take place in secret, as the government looks at data you may not even know has been collected about you, and gives you no opportunity to answer the questions yourself so you could perhaps explain errors or extenuating circumstances in the information that has been gathered about you. Another brainchild of Poindexter and DARPA was the policy analysis market, which the government was to put up on a website. Apparently, Poindexter reasoned that commodity futures markets worked so well for Bush's buddies at Enron that he could adapt it to predicting terrorism. Individuals would be able to invest in hypothetical futures contracts involving the likelihood of such events as an assassination of Yasser Arafat or the overthrow of Jordan's King Abdullah II. Other futures would be available based on the economic health, civil stability, and military involvement in Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Turkey, all oil-related countries. The proposed market lasted about one day after it was revealed to the Senate. Senators Wyden and Dorgan protested the Pentagon's $8 million request, and Wyden said, "Make-believe markets trading impossibilities that turn the stomach hardly seem like a sensible next step to take with taxpayer money in the war on terror." As a result of the uproar over this, Poindexter was asked to step down. America has always stood for the principle that the government may not spy on its citizens unless there is probable cause to believe that a citizen is involved in wrongdoing. Even then, the spying must be approved by a judge. When we are being questioned lawfully, we have always had the constitutional right to refuse to answer any question. Those rights are out the window with programs like TIA. There is usually very little in the way of an electronic or paper trail when it comes to terrorists. They pay cash and lay low. You and me, however, we leave trails everywhere. Credit cards, cell phones, medical records, online, everything we do. Who is really being watched here? Never mind that this was just another layer of bureaucracy created by the party that spends most of its time railing against the federal government and its layers of bureaucracy. And then there are those who exist in some sort of terror limbo, the prisoners of Guantanamo Bay. All of a sudden, we were really excited to have Cuba right next door. What better place to put all our newly captured evildoers? 680 people, including three children ages 13 to 16, are incarcerated there indefinitely. No charges, no sentence to serve, no lawyers, no nothing. Is it any wonder there have been 28 suicide attempts among those imprisoned there? To date, there are already at least 34 documented cases of FBI abuse under the Patriot Act, and at least another 966 individuals have filed formal complaints. Many of these people were just minding their own business or seeking to partake in our free and open society. Consider these examples. John Clark, an organizer with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP, was detained at the American border by immigration officials on his way to a speaking engagement at Michigan State University. A State Department agent drove in from Detroit and interrogated Clark about his participation in anti-globalization protests, about whether he opposed the ideology of the United States, and even about the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden. The agent presented a State Department folder on OCAP that included the name of a man with whom Clark had stayed in Chicago, and leaflets from Clark's previous speaking engagements in the U.S. A suburban New York judge asked Anissa Coder, a U.S. citizen of Lebanese descent, if she was a terrorist when she appeared in court over parking tickets. In May 2002, six French journalists were stopped at Los Angeles International Airport, interrogated, and subjected to body searches. They were detained for more than a day and expelled from the United States before they could reach their final destination, a video game trade show. At a high school in Vermont, a uniformed police officer entered teacher Tom Treese's classroom at 1:30 a.m. to photograph a student art project that depicted President Bush with duct tape over his mouth and the caption, Put your duct tape to good use. Shut your mouth. Treese was removed from teaching his current events class. A college student from North Carolina, A.J. Brown, was visited by two Secret Service agents who questioned her about her possession of anti-American material. Without inviting them in, Brown showed the agents what she assumed they came for, an anti-death penalty poster showing Bush and a group of lynched bodies with the caption, "We hang on your every word." North Carolina Green Party activist Doug Stuber was detained and questioned while trying to fly to Prague, then told that no Greens were allowed to fly that day. His interrogator showed him a document from the Justice Department that showed that Greens were likely terrorists, and the Secret Service took a mugshot. Stuber was forced to turn back. There are other incidents that, while they may not be the work of the feds, they represent the chilling effect that this has had on our society. Here are two examples. CBS fired a producer of Hitler, The Rise of Evil, for statements he made comparing the mood of America to that in Germany when Hitler ascended to power. And a 12th grade teacher at English High School in Lynn, Massachusetts, was forced to stop showing my film Bowling for Columbine to her classes because the principal said the movie contains anti-war messages. As you can see, the effects of Bush's actions go far beyond issues related to terrorism. There is an atmosphere that has been created that people had better watch what they say or do every day. In fact, no less an authority than White House spokesman Ari Fleischer warned critics of the Bush administration, and specifically comedian Bill Maher, to watch what they say, watch what they do. What really gets to me is the way this band of deceivers has used September 11 as the excuse for everything. It's no longer just to pass measures to protect us from a terrorist threat. September 11 is now the answer. It is the manna from heaven the right has always prayed for. Want a new weapon system? Have to have it. Why? Well, 9/11. Want to relax the pollution laws? It's a must. Why? 9/11. Want to outlaw abortion? Absolutely. Why? 9/11. What does 9/11 have to do with abortion? Hey, why are you questioning the government? Someone call the FBI. To the rest of the world, it looks like we've gone mad. People in most other countries have been living with acts of terrorism for years, some for decades. What do they do? Well, they don't go crazy with fear. The average German doesn't stock up on duct tape or stop using the subway. They just learn to live with it. Shit happens. But what do? We invent color-coded threat charts. We frisk 90-year-olds in wheelchairs. We attack the Bill of Rights. Yeah, that'll show those terrorists. Let's dismantle our way of life so they won't have to blow it up. This makes no sense. None of this is to say that certain rational precautions shouldn't be taken to prevent those few acts of terror that do occur. Perhaps George W. Bush should have made it a point to read the reports the CIA sent him. On August 6, 2001, according to the Washington Post, just weeks before September 11, Bush was given a comprehensive report marked urgent, warning him that Al-Qaeda was planning a major attack on the U.S. The full contents of the memo are not known because Bush has refused to release it, despite Condoleezza Rice saying repeatedly that there was nothing specific in the report. If there's nothing specific, then why can't they release it? Worse, a 1999 report had already warned that Al-Qaeda was looking into using planes as missiles with the intention of crashing them into government buildings. Why didn't Bush, with an intelligence memo in his hands warning that attacks were imminent, coupled with the reports passed along by the Clinton administration, alert the nation? Was he too busy taking his month-long vacation in Crawford, Texas? Bush failed to do his job, and it may have cost 3,000 people their lives. That alone should be enough to haul him before an impeachment tribunal. Lying about sex, as far as I know, cost no one their life in the Clinton White House. For instance, what if, during the late 1990s, the Republicans had let the FBI do its real job, protecting the lives of our citizens, instead of having them spend countless hours investigating the sex habits of the president or some rinky-dink land deal of the first ladies? At one point, more than 200 FBI agents were assigned to some portion of the witch hunt to get the Clintons. 200 agents who, maybe, should have been returning calls from flight schools in Texas that were worried they had strange guys not wanting to learn how to take off or land a plane. 200 FBI agents who should have been checking how terrorists got to stay in the country long after their visas expired. 200 FBI agents who should have been training airport security. 200 FBI agents who should have been doing anything other than having their time wasted by vindictive, sex-obsessed, right-wing Republicans wanting to write a $50 million porn book about where the president kept his cigars. There has been a lot of talk about what Bush might have done to prevent September 11 in the month before it happened, but no one is talking about an action 14 years before September 11 that almost certainly would have prevented the tragedy, at a cost of 50 cents more per airline ticket. In 1987, I went to work for a while in Ralph Nader's office in Washington, D.C. What was one of the projects Nader's Raiders were working on at that time? They were lobbying the government to make airline travel safer and pushing for all the airlines to install new cockpit doors that would be impenetrable. The airline industry objected loudly and refused to do a thing. Of course, had they listened to Nader then, would the 19 hijackers have been able to get control of those planes? I can pretty much guarantee the 3,000 who died that September day would be alive today had Nader's group prevailed 14 years earlier. When we are talking about terrorists, we need to accept and admit that most acts of terror are inside jobs, and most terrorists are homegrown. We must stop thinking that it is the foreigner, the stranger, who is out to harm us. That is rarely the case. We've learned a lot about this in modern times. We now know that when a person is killed, the vast majority of time the victim knows the murderer. Children are molested usually not by the mythical stranger in a trench coat, but rather by a family member, neighbor, or friendly clergy. Arsonists are far too often former firefighters. Burglars are many times people who have been in or worked on your home. With all the security set up at New York's City Hall to protect it from some scary 9/11-style terrorists, it was a city councilman who walked his own killer around the metal detectors with the police's acquiescence. And when it has come to people hijacking and crashing airplanes, the only two times this happened before September 11, it was insiders, the airline's own people, not madmen outsiders. Only airline employees have been responsible for such mass murder hijacking until 9/11/01. A disgruntled U.S. Air employee did not have to walk through security and brought a gun on board in December 1987 and crashed a plane in California. And on November 16, 1999, an Egyptian airline employee took over the controls and crashed that plane into the Atlantic Ocean. It is crucial to stop thinking of the terrorists as masked, anonymous, and foreign. More likely, it's someone you know. You're having a drink with him right now. I've always thought it was interesting that the mass murder of September 11 was allegedly committed by a multimillionaire. We always say it was committed by a terrorist or by an Islamic fundamentalist or an Arab, but we never define Osama by his rightful title, multimillionaire. Why have we never read a headline saying, 3,000 killed by multimillionaire? It would be a correct headline, would it not? No part of it is untrue. Osama bin Laden has assets totaling at least $30 million. He is a multimillionaire. So why isn't that the way we see this person? As a rich fuck who kills people? Why didn't that become the reason for profiling potential terrorists? Instead of rounding up suspicious Arabs, why don't we say, oh my God, a multimillionaire killed 3,000 people. Round up the multimillionaires. Throw them all in jail. No charges, no trials. Deport the millionaires. We need protection from our own multimillionaire corporate terrorists, the ones who rip off our old age pensions, destroy the environment, deplete irreplaceable fossil fuels in the name of profit, deny us our right to universal health care, take people's jobs away whenever the mood hits them. What do you call a 19% increase in the homeless and the hungry from 2001 to 2002? Are these not acts of terrorism? Do they not cost lives? Is it not all part of a calculated plan to inflict pain on the poor and the working poor, just so that a few rich men can get even richer? We have our own terrorists to deal with, and we need our entire focus returned to them so that we can one day live in a country where the people once again pick the president, a country where the wealthy learn that they have to pay for their actions, a free country, a safe country, a peaceful country that genuinely shares its riches with the less fortunate around the world, a country that believes in everyone getting a fair shake, and where fear is seen as the only thing we truly need to fear. Chapter 5. How to Stop Terrorism? Stop Being Terrorists! Welcome to Mike's Quick and Easy Guide to Preventing Future Terrorist Attacks. Yes, that's right. There will be future terrorist attacks. How do I know this? Because that's what they tell us every bloody day. I know I just said there really is no terrorist threat, but in case I'm wrong, it probably isn't a bad idea to be prepared. I have studied this matter thoroughly, and because I spend a good chunk of my year on Manhattan Island, the target of choice for international evildoers, I have made this study a top priority. Why?